Of course I am, Burns said with a wholesome grin that could have landed him a starring role on the West Wing. You can trust me, Alex. Always. Absolutely. Just like you trusted Kyle Craig a few years back. Jesus. He was giving me the shivers. Or maybe the director was just trying to get me to see the world his way. Trust no one. Go to the head of the class. Chapter 12. At a little past 11, I was on my way down to Quantico. Even after my final in Baltimore, I still had a class on stress management and law enforcement. I already knew the operative statistic. FBI agents were 5 times more likely to kill themselves than to be killed in the line of duty. A Billy Collins poem was floating through my brain as I drove. Another reason why I don't keep a gun in the house. Nice concept. Good poem. Bad omen. The cell rang, and I heard the voice of Tony Woods from the director's office. There had been a change of plans. Woods gave me orders from the director to go straight to Ronald Reagan Washington National Airport. A plane was waiting for me. Jesus. I was on another case already. I'd been ordered to skip school again. Things were happening faster than even I had expected, and I wasn't sure if that was a good or a bad thing. Does Senior Agent Nooney know that I'm the director's one-man flying squad? I asked Woods. Tell me that he does, I thought. I don't need more trouble down at Quantico. We'll let him know post-haste where you're going, Woods promised. I'll take care of it personally. Go to Atlanta and keep us posted on what you find down there. You'll be briefed on the plane. It's a kidnapping case. But that was all Tony Woods would tell me on the phone. For the most part, the Bureau flies out of Reagan Washington National. I boarded a Cessna Citation Ultra, tan, with no identifying markings. The Cessna said 8, but I was the only passenger. You must be important, the pilot said, before we took off. I'm not important, believe me. I'm nobody. The pilot just laughed. Buckle up, then, nobody. It was perfectly clear that a call from the director's office had preceded me. Here I was, being treated like a senior agent, the director's troubleshooter. Another agent jumped aboard just before we took off. He sat down across the aisle from me and introduced himself as Wyatt Walsh from D.C. Was he part of the director's flying team, too? Maybe my partner? What happened in Atlanta? I asked. What's so important or unimportant that it requires our services? Nobody told you? He seemed surprised that I didn't know the details. I got a call from the director's office less than half an hour ago. I was told to come here. They said I'd be briefed on the plane. Walsh slapped 2 volumes of case notes on my lap. There's been a kidnapping in the Buckhead section of Atlanta. Woman in her 30s. White woman, well-to-do. She's the wife of a judge, which makes it federal. More important, she isn't the first. Chapter 13. Everything was suddenly in a hurry-up mode. After we landed, I was driven in a van to the Phipps Plaza Shopping Center in Buckhead. As we pulled into the lot off Peachtree, it was obvious to me that something was very wrong there. We passed the anchor stores, Saks Fifth Avenue and Lord & Taylor. They were nearly empty. Agent Walsh told me that the victim, Mrs. Elizabeth Connolly, had been abducted in the underground parking lot near another large store called Parisian. The entire parking area was a crime scene, but particularly Level 3, where Mrs. Connolly had been grabbed. Each level of the garage was marked with a purple and gold scroll design, but now crime scene tape was draped over the scrolls. The Bureau's evidence response team was there. The incredible amount of activity indicated that the local police agencies were taking this extremely seriously. Walsh's words were floating in my head. She isn't the first. It struck me as a little ironic, but I was more comfortable talking to the local police than to agents from the Bureau's field office. I walked over and spoke to 2 detectives, Petey and Ciaccio, from the Atlanta PD. I'll try to stay out of your way, I said to them, then added, I used to be Washington PD.
Sold out, huh?
Chiacho said, and she sniffed out a laugh. It was supposed to be a joke, but it had enough truth in it to sting. Her eyes had a light frost in them. Petey spoke up. He looked about 10 years older than his partner. Both were attractive. Why is the FBI interested in this case? I told them only as much as I thought I should. Not everything. There have been other abductions, or at least disappearances, that resemble this one. White women, suburban locales. We're here checking into possible connections. And, of course, this is a judge's wife. Petey asked, Are we talking about past disappearances in the Atlanta metro area? I shook my head. No, not to my knowledge. The other disappearances are in Texas, Massachusetts, Florida, Arkansas. Ransoms involved? Petey followed up. In one Texas case, yes. Otherwise, no money has been asked for. None of the women have been found so far.
Only white women?
Detective Chacho asked as she took a few notes. As far as we know, yes. And all of them fairly well-to-do. But no ransoms. And none of what I'm telling you gets to the press. I looked around the parking garage. What do we have so far? Help me out a little. Chacho looked at Petey. Joshua? She asked. Petey shrugged. All right, Irene.
We do have something. There were a couple of kids in one of the parked cars where the abduction went down. They didn't witness the first part of the crime.
They were otherwise occupied, said Joshua Petey.
But they looked up when they heard a scream and saw Elizabeth Connolly. Two kidnappers, apparently good at it. Man and a woman. They didn't see our young lovers because they were in the back of a van.
And they had their heads down, I asked. Otherwise occupied?
That, too. But when they did come up for air, they saw the man and woman, described as being in their 30s, well-dressed. They were already holding Mrs. Connolly. Took her down very fast. Threw her into the back of her own station wagon. Then they drove off in her car.
Why didn't the kids get out of the van to help? Chacho shook her head.
They said that it happened very fast and that they were scared. Seemed unreal to them. I think they were also nervous about having it known they were playing around in the back of a van during school hours. They both attend a local prep school in Buckhead. They were skipping classes.
A team took her, I thought, and knew it was a big break for us. According to what I'd read on the ride down, no team had been spotted at any of the other abductions. A male and a female team? That was interesting. Strange and unexpected.
You want to answer a question for us now?
Detective Petey asked.
If I can. Shoot.
He looked at his partner.
I had a feeling that somewhere along the way, Joshua and Irene might have spent some time in the back seat of a car. Something about the way they looked at each other.
We've been hearing that this might have to do with the Sandra Friedlander case. Is that right? That one's gone unsolved for what, 2 years in D.C.?
I looked at the detective and shook my head. Not to my knowledge, I said. You're the first to bring up Sandra Friedlander. Which wasn't exactly the truth. Her name had been in confidential FBI reports I'd read on the ride down from D.C. Sandra Friedlander and seven others.
Chapter 14.
My head was buzzing, in a bad way. I knew from my hurried reading of the case notes that there were more than 220 women currently listed as missing in the United States, and that at least seven of the disappearances had been linked by the Bureau to white slave rings. That was the nasty twist. White women in their 20s and 30s were in high demand in certain circles. The prices could get exorbitant if the sales were to the Middle East or to Japan. Atlanta had been the hub of another kind of sex slave scandal just a few years back. It had involved Asian and Mexican women smuggled into the U.S., then forced into prostitution in Georgia and the Carolinas. This case had another possible connection to Juanita, Mexico, where hundreds of women had disappeared in the past couple of years.
My mind was flashing through these unpleasantries when I arrived at Judge Brendan Connolly's home in the Tuxedo Park section of Buckhead, near the governor's mansion. The Connolly place replicated an 1840s upcountry Georgia plantation home and sat on about 2 acres. A Porsche Boxster was parked in the circular driveway. Everything looked perfect in its place. The front door was opened by a young girl who was still in her school clothes. The patch on her jumper told me she attended Pace Academy. She introduced herself as Bridget Connolly, and I could see braces on her teeth. I had read about Bridget in the Bureau's notes on the family. The foyer of the house was elegant, with an elaborate chandelier and a highly polished ash hardwood floor. I spotted 2 younger girls, just their heads, peeking out from a doorway off the main entryway, just past a couple of British watercolors. All 3 of the Connolly daughters were pretty. Bridget was 12, Meredith was 11, and Gwyn was 6. According to my crib notes, the younger girls attended the Lovett School. "I'm Alex Cross with the FBI," I said to Bridget, who seemed tremendously self-assured for her age, especially during this crisis. "I think that your father is expecting me."
"My dad will be right down, sir," she told me.
Then she turned to her younger sisters and scolded.
"You heard, Daddy. Behave, both of you."
"I won't bite anybody," I said to the girls, who were still peeking at me from down the hallway. Meredith turned bright red.
"Oh, we're sorry. This isn't about you."
"I understand," I said. Finally, they smiled, and I saw that Meredith had braces too. Very cute girls. Sweet. I heard a voice from above. "Agent Cross?" Agent? I wasn't used to the sound of that yet. I looked up the front staircase as Judge Brendan Connolly made his way down. He had on a striped blue dress shirt, dark blue slacks, black driving loafers. He looked trim and in shape, but tired, as if he hadn't slept in days. I knew from the FBI workup sheets that he was 44 and had attended Georgia Tech and Vanderbilt Law School. "So, which is it?" he asked, then forced a smile. "Do you bite or not?" I shook his hand. "I only bite people who deserve it," I said. "Alex Cross." Brendan Connolly nodded toward a large library den that I could see was crammed from floor to ceiling with books. There was also room for a baby grand piano. I noticed sheet music for some Billy Joel songs. In the corner of the room was a daybed, unmade. "After Agent Cross and I are done, I'll make dinner," he said to the girls. "I'll try not to poison anybody tonight, but I'll need your help, ladies."
"Yes, Daddy,"
they chorused. They seemed to adore their father. He pulled the sliding oak doors, and the 2 of us were sealed inside. "This is so damn bad. So hard." He let out a deep breath. "Trying to keep up a front for them. They are the best girls in the world." Judge Connolly gestured around the book-lined room. "This is Lizzie's favorite place in the house. She plays the piano very well. So do the girls. We are both bookaholics, but she especially loved reading in this room." He sat in a club chair covered in rust-tone leather. "I appreciate that you came to Atlanta. I've heard you're very good at difficult cases. How can I help you?" he asked. I sat across from him on a matching rust-tone leather couch. On the wall behind him were photographs of the Parthenon, Chartres, the pyramids, and an honorary plaque from Chastain Horse Park. "There are a lot of people working to find Mrs. Connolly, and they'll go down a lot of avenues. I'm not going to get into too many details about your family. The local detectives can go there." "Thank you," the judge said. "Those questions are devastating to answer right now. To go over and over, you can't imagine." I nodded. "Are you aware of any local men or even women who might have taken an inappropriate interest in your wife? A long-standing crush, a potential obsession?" That's the one private area I'd like to go into. Then, any little things that strike you as out of the ordinary? Did you notice anyone watching your wife? Are there any faces you've seen around more than normal lately? Delivery men? Federal Express or other services? Neighbors who are suspicious in any way? Work associates? Even friends who might have fantasized about Mrs. Connolly? Brendan Connolly nodded. I see what you're getting at. I looked him in the eye. Have you and your wife had any fights lately? I asked. I need to know if you have. Then we can move on. Wetness suddenly appeared in the corners of Brendan Connolly's eyes. I met Lizzie in Washington when she was with the Post, and I was an associate at Tate Shilling, a law firm there. It was love at first sight. We almost never fought, hardly ever raised our voices. That's still true. Agent Cross, I love my wife. So do her daughters. Please help us bring her home. You have to find Lizzie.
Chapter 15.
The modern-day godfather. A 47-year-old Russian, now living in America and known as the Wolf. Rumored to be fearless, hands-on, into everything from weapon sales, extortion, and drugs, to legitimate businesses, such as banking and venture capital, no one seemed to know his true identity, or his American name, or where he lived. Clever. Invisible. Safe from the FBI and anybody else who might be looking for him. He had been in his 20s when he made the switch from the KGB to become one of the most ruthless cell leaders in Russian organized crime, the Red Mafia. His namesake, the Siberian Wolf, was a skillful hunter, but also relentlessly hunted. The Siberian was a fast runner and could overpower much heavier animals, but it was also hunted for its blood and bones. The human wolf was also a hunter who was hunted, except that the police had no idea where to hunt. Invisible, by design. Actually, he was hiding in plain sight. On a balmy evening, the man called Wolf was throwing a huge party at his 20,000-square-foot house on the waterfront in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. The occasion was the launch of his new men's magazine, called Instinct, which would compete with Maxim and Stun. In Lauderdale, the Wolf was known as Ari Manning, a wealthy businessman originally from Tel Aviv. He had other names in other cities. Many names, many cities. He was passing through the den now, where about 20 of his guests were watching a football game on several TVs, including a 61-inch Runco. A couple of football fanatics were bent over a computer with a statistics database. On a nearby table was a bottle of Stolichnaya encased in a block of ice. The vodka in ice was the only real Russian touch that he allowed. At 6'2", this wolf could carry 240 pounds and still move like a big and very powerful animal. He circulated among his guests, always smiling and joking, knowing that no one in the room understood why he smiled. Not one of these so-called friends or business partners or social acquaintances had any idea who he was. They knew him as Ari, not as Pasha Sorokin, and definitely not as the Wolf. They had no clue about the pounds of illegal diamonds he bought from Sierra Leone, the tons of heroin from Asia, and weapons and even jets sold to the Colombians, or white women purchased by the Saudis and Japanese. In South Florida, he had a reputation for being a maverick, both socially and in business. There were more than 150 guests tonight, but he ordered food and drink for twice that number. He had imported the chef from Le Cirque 2000 in New York, and also a sushi cook from San Francisco. His servers were dressed as cheerleaders and were topless, which he thought a cheeky joke, guaranteed to offend. The famous surprise dessert for the party was soccer torts flown in from Vienna. No wonder everybody loved Ari, or hated him. He gave a playful hug to a former pro running back for the Miami Dolphins and talked to a lawyer who'd made tens of millions from the Florida tobacco settlement, exchanged stories about Governor Jeb Bush. Then he moved on through the crowd. There were so many ass-kissing social climbers and opportunists who came to his house to be seen among the right and wrong people. Self-important, spoiled, selfish, and worst of all, boring as tepid dishwater. He walked along the edge of an indoor swimming pool toward an outdoor pool more than twice the size. He chatted with his guests and made a generous pledge to a private school charity. Not surprisingly, he was hit on by somebody's wife. He had serious conversations with the owner of the most important hotel in the state, a Mercedes-dealing mogul, and the head of a conglomerate who was a hunting buddy of his. He despised all of these pretenders, especially the older used-to-bes. None of them had ever taken a real risk in their lives. Still, they had made millions, even billions, and they thought they were such hot shit. And then he thought about Elizabeth Connolly for the first time in an hour or so, his sweet, very sexy Lizzie. She looked like Claudia Schiffer, and he fondly remembered the days when the image of the German model was on hundreds of billboards all over Moscow. He had lusted for Claudia, all Russian men had, and now he had her likeness in his possession. Why? Because he could. It was the philosophy that drove him and everything in his life. For that very reason, he was keeping her right here in his big house in Fort Lauderdale.
Chapter 16.
Lizzie Connolly couldn't believe any of this awfulness was happening to her. It still didn't seem possible. It wasn't possible. And yet here she was, a hostage. The house where she was being kept was full of people. Full. It sounded as if a party was going on. A party? How dare he? Was her insane captor that sure of himself? Was he so arrogant, so brazen? Was it possible? Of course it was. He'd boasted to her that he was a gangster, the king of gangsters, perhaps the greatest that ever lived. He had repulsive tattoos on the back of his right hand, his shoulders, his back, around his right index finger, and also on his private parts, on his testicles and penis. Lizzie could definitely hear a party going on in the house. She could even make out conversations. Small talk about an upcoming trip to Aspen, a rumored affair between a nanny and a local mother, the death of a child in a pool, a six-year-old like her Gwyn, football stories, a joke about two altar boys and a Siamese cat that she'd already heard in Atlanta. Who the hell were these people? Where was she being held? Where am I, damn it? Lizzie was trying so hard not to go crazy, but it was almost impossible. All of these people, their inane talk, they were so close to where she was bound and tied and gagged and being held hostage by a madman, probably a killer. As Lizzie listened, tears finally began to run down her cheeks. Their voices, their closeness, their laughing, all just a few feet away from her. I'm here. I'm right here. Damn it. Help me. Please help me. I'm right here. She was in darkness. Couldn't see a thing. The people, the party, were on the other side of a thick wooden door. She was locked in a small room that was part closet. She'd been kept there for days. Permitted bathroom breaks, but not much else. Bound tightly by rope, gagged with tape. So she couldn't call out for help. Lizzie couldn't scream, except inside her head. Please help me. Somebody, please. I'm here. I'm right here. I don't want to die. Because that was the one thing he told her that was certain. He was going to kill her.
Chapter 17.
But no one could hear Lizzie Connolly. The party went on and got larger, noisier, more extravagant, vulgar. 11 times during the night, stretch limousines dropped off well-heeled guests at the large waterfront house in Fort Lauderdale. Then the limos left. They would not be waiting for their passengers. No one noticed, at least no one let on. And no one paid any attention when these same guests left that night in cars they hadn't arrived in. Very expensive cars, the finest in the world, all of them stolen. An NFL running back departed in a deep maroon Rolls-Royce Corniche convertible worth $363,000, made to order. From the paint to the wood, hide trim, even the position of the intercrossed R's in the cockpit. A white rap star drove off on an aqua blue Aston Martin Vanquish priced at $228,000, capable of 0 to 100 in under 10 seconds. The most expensive of the cars was the American-made Saleen S7 with its gull-wing doors, the look of a shark, and 550 horsepower. All in all, 11 very expensive, very stolen automobiles were delivered to buyers at the house. A silver Pagani Zonda, priced at $370,000. The engine of the Italian-made racer barked, howled, roared. A silver and orange-trimmed Spyker C8 Double 12 with 620 horsepower. A bronze Bentley Azure Mulliner convertible. Yours for $376,000. A Ferrari 575 Maranello, $215,000. A Porsche GT2. Two Lamborghini Murcielagos, yellow gold, $270,000 apiece, named, like all Lamborghinis, after a famous bull. A Hummer H1, not as hot as the other cars, maybe, but nothing got in its way. The total value of the stolen cars was over $3 million. The sales came to a little under $2 million, which more than paid for the soccer torts flown all the way from Vienna. And besides, the wolf was a fan of fast, beautiful cars, of fast, beautiful everything.
Chapter 18. I flew back to D.C. the next day and was home at 6 that night, finished with work for the day. At times like this, I almost felt that maybe I had my life back. Maybe I'd done the right thing by joining the Bureau. Maybe. As I climbed out of the ancient black Porsche, I saw Janny on the front porch. She was practicing her violin, her long bows. She wanted to be the next Midori. The playing was impressive. To me, anyway. When Janny wanted something, she went after it. "Who's the beautiful young lady holding that Jusek so perfectly?" I called as I trudged up the lawn. Janny glanced my way, said nothing, smiled knowingly, as if only she knew the secret. Nana and I were involved in her practices, which featured the Suzuki method of instruction. We modified the method slightly to include both of us. Parents were a part of practice, and it seemed to pay dividends. In the Suzuki way, great care was taken to avoid competition and its negative effects. Parents were told to listen to countless tapes and attend lessons. I had gone to many of the lessons myself. Nana covered the others. In that way, we assumed the dual role of home teacher. "That's so beautiful. What a wonderful sound to come home to," I told Janny. Her smile was worth everything I'd gone through at work that day. She finally spoke. "To soothe the savage beast," she said. Violin under one arm, bow held down, Janny bowed, and then she began to play again. I sat on the porch steps and listened. Just the two of us, the setting sun and the music. The beast was soothed. After she finished practice, we ate a light dinner, then hurried over to the Kennedy Center for one of the free programs in the Grand Foyer. Tonight it was Liszt and Virtuosity. But wait, there was more. Tomorrow night we planned to attack the new climbing wall at the Capital Y. Then, with Damon, it was a video game extravaganza featuring Eternal Darkness, Sanity's Requiem, and Warcraft III, Reign of Chaos. I hoped we could keep it up like this. Even the video games. I was on the right track now, and I liked it. So did Nana and the kids. Around 10:30, to complete the day just right, I got hold of Jamila on the phone. She was home at a decent hour for a change. "Hey," she said at the sound of my voice.
Hey, back at you. Can you talk? This a good time?
Might be able to squeeze in a couple of minutes for you. I hope you're calling from home. Are you?
Been here since around 6. We had a family night at the Kennedy Center. Big success.
I'm jealous.
We talked about what she was up to. Then my big night with the kids, and finally my life and times with the Bureau. But I had the sense that Jamila needed to get off after about 15 minutes. I didn't ask if she had anything going for tonight. She'd tell me if she wanted to. I miss you way out there in San Francisco, I said, and left it at that. I hoped it didn't come off as not caring, because I did care about Jam. She was in my thoughts all the time.
I have to run, Alex. Bye, she said.
Bye. Jamila had to run, and I was finally trying to stop. Chapter 19. The next morning, I was told to attend a key person meeting about the Connolly kidnapping and the possibility that the abduction was connected to others in the past 12 months. The case had been upgraded to Major, and it had the code name White Girl. An FBI Rapid Start team had already been dispatched to Atlanta. Satellite photos of the Phipps Plaza shopping center had been ordered, in the hope that we could identify the motor vehicle the unsubs had used to get there before driving away in the Connolly station wagon. There were about 2 dozen agents in a windowless major case room at the Bureau in Washington. When I arrived, I learned that Washington would be the office of origin for the case, which meant the case was important to Director Burns. The Criminal Investigative Division had already prepared a briefing book for him. The important entry point for the FBI was that a federal judge's wife had disappeared. Ned Mahoney from HRT sat down next to me and seemed not just outgoing, but friendly. He greeted me with a winking, "Hey, Star." A tiny dark-haired woman in a black jumpsuit plopped down on the other side of me. She introduced herself as Monnie Donnelly and told me she was the violent crimes analyst attached to the case. She talked extraordinarily fast, lots of energy, almost too much.
"Guess we'll be working together," she said, and shook my hand. "I've already heard good things about you. I know your resume. I attended Hopkins for grad school, too. How about that?"
"Monnie's our best and our brightest," Mahoney interjected, "and that's a gross understatement."
"He's so right," Monnie Donnelly agreed. "Spread the word, please. I'm tired of being a secret weapon."
I noticed that my supervisor, Gordon Nooney, wasn't in the room of at least 50 agents. Then the meeting began on White Girl. A senior agent named Walter Zelrus stood in the front and started to show slides. He was professional but very dry. I almost felt as if I'd joined IBM or Chase Manhattan Bank instead of the FBI.
Monnie whispered, "Don't worry, it'll get worse. He's just warming up."
Zelrus had a droning speaking voice that reminded me of a professor I'd had a long time ago at Hopkins. Both Zelrus and my former professor gave everything equal weight, never seemed excited or disturbed about the material they were presenting. Zelrus's subject was the connection the Connolly abduction might have had to several others in the past months, so it ought to have been spellbinding.
"Gerald Gottlieb,"
Monnie Donnelly whispered again. I smiled, almost laughed out loud. Gottlieb was the professor who used to drone on at Hopkins. "Upscale, attractive white women," Zelrus was saying, "have been disappearing at a rate a little over 3 times the statistical norm over the past year. This is true both here in the States and in Eastern Europe. I'm going to pass around an actual catalog showing women who were up for sale about 3 months ago. Unfortunately, we were unable to trace the catalog back to whoever manufactured it. There was a Miami link, but it never went anywhere." When the catalog got to me, I saw that it was black and white, the pages probably printed off the internet. I quickly leafed through it. There were 17 women shown, nude shots, along with details such as breast and waist size, true color of hair, and color of eyes. The women had unlikely nicknames like Candy, Sable, Foxy, Madonna, and Ripe. The prices ranged from $3,500 to $150,000. There was no further biographical information on any of the women, and nothing at all about their personalities.
"We've been working closely with Interpol on what we suspect could be white slave trading. FYI, white slave refers to women bought and sold specifically for the purpose of prostitution. These days, the women are usually Asian, Mexican, and South American, not white, except in Eastern Europe. You should also note that at this time, slavery is more globalized and technologized than ever in history. Some countries in Asia look the other way as women and children are sold, especially into Japan and India. In the past couple of years, a market has opened up for white women, particularly blondes. These women are sold for prices ranging from a few hundred up into the mid-five figures and possibly higher. As I said, a significant market is Japan. Another is the Middle East, of course. The Saudis are the biggest buyers. Believe it or not, there's even a market in Iraq and Iran. Questions at this point?
There were several. Mostly good ones, which showed me this was a savvy group that had been brought together. I finally asked a question, though I was reluctant to as the FNG. "Why do we think Elizabeth Connolly is connected to the others?" I gestured around the room. "I mean, this connected?" Zelris answered quickly.
"A team took her. Kidnapping gangs are very common in the slave trade, especially in Eastern Europe. They're experienced and very efficient at the abductions, and they're connected into a pipeline. There's usually a buyer before they take a woman like Mrs. Connolly. She would be high risk, but very high reward. What makes this kind of abduction attractive is that there's no ransom exchange. The Connolly abduction fits our profile."
Someone asked, "Could a buyer request a specific woman? Is that a possibility?"
Zelris nodded.
"If the money is right, yes, absolutely. The price might go into the six figures. We're working that angle."
Most of the remainder of the long meeting was taken up with discussion about Mrs. Connolly and whether we could find her quickly. The consensus was no. One detail was particularly perplexing. Why would the unsubs kidnap the victim in such a public place? Profit slash ransom seemed the logical possibility. But there had been no ransom note. Had somebody specifically asked for Mrs. Elizabeth Connolly? If so, who? What was special about her? And why the mall? Surely there were easier abduction locations. As we talked about her, a photograph of Mrs. Connolly and her three daughters remained on the screen at the front of the conference room. The four of them looked so close-knit and happy. It was scary. Sad. I found myself thinking about being with Janny on our front porch the night before. Someone asked, "These women who've been abducted, have any of them been found?"
"Not one," said Agent Zelris. "Our fear is that they're dead, that the kidnappers or whoever the kidnappers deliver them to consider them disposable."
Chapter 20.
I returned to my orientation classes that day after the lunch break, and just in time for another of SSA Horowitz's awful jokes. He held up a clipboard for us to see his material. The official list of David Koresh's theme songs: "You Light Up My Life," "I'm Burning Up," "Great Balls of Fire." My personal favorite: "Burning Down the House." Love the talking heads. Dr. Horowitz seemed to know that his jokes were bad, but black humor works with police officers, and his deadpan delivery was decent. Plus, he knew who had recorded Burning Down the House. We had an hour session on management of integrated cases, followed by law enforcement communication, then dynamics of the pattern killer. In the last course, we were told that serial killers change, that they are dynamic. In other words, they get smarter and better at killing. Only the ritual characteristics remain the same. I didn't bother to take notes. The next class took place outdoors. We were all dressed in sports jackets, but with padded throat and face protectors for a practical at Hogan's Alley. The exercise involved three cars in hot pursuit of a fourth. Sirens blared and echoed. Loudspeakers barked commands. Stop! Pull over! Come out of the car with your hands up! Our ammo, simmunition, consisted of cartridges with pink paint-infused tips. It was 5 o'clock by the time we finished the exercise. I showered and dressed, and as I was leaving the training building to go over to the dining hall building where I had a cubicle, I saw SSA Nooney. He motioned for me to come over. What if I don't want to? You headed back to D.C.? He asked. I nodded and bit down on my tongue. In a while, I have some reports to read first. The abduction in Atlanta. Big stuff. I'm impressed. The rest of your classmates spend their nights here. Some of them think it helps build camaraderie. I think so, too. Are you an agent of change? I shook my head, then tried a smile on Nooney. Didn't work. I was told from the start that I could go home nights. That isn't possible for most of the others. Then Nooney began to push hard, trying to stir up old anger. I heard you had some problems with your chief of detectives in D.C., too, he said. Everybody had problems with Chief of Detectives Pittman, I said. Nooney's eyes appeared glazed. It was obvious he didn't see it that way. Just about everybody has problems with me, too. Doesn't mean I'm wrong about the importance of building a team here. I'm not wrong, Cross. I resisted saying anything more. Nooney was coming down on me again. Why? I had attended the classes I could make. I still had work to do on White Girl. Like it or not, I was part of the case. And this wasn't another practical. It was real. It was important. I have to get my work done, I finally said. Then I walked away from Nooney. I was pretty sure I'd made my first enemy in the FBI. An important one, too. No sense starting small.
Chapter 21.
Maybe it was guilt, churned up by my confrontation with Gordon Nooney, that made me work late in my cube on the lower level of the dining hall building where behavioral science had its offices. The low ceilings, bad fluorescent lighting, and cinder block walls kind of made me feel as if I were back at my precinct. But the depth of the back files and research available to FBI agents was astonishing. The Bureau's resources were better than anything I'd ever seen in the D.C. Police Department. It took me a couple of hours to go through less than a quarter of the white slave trade files, and those were just cases in the U.S. One abduction in particular caught my attention. It involved a female D.C. attorney named Ruth Morgenstern. She had last been seen at approximately 9:30 p.m. on August 20th. A friend had dropped her off near her apartment in Foggy Bottom. Ms. Morgenstern was 26 years old, 111 pounds, with blue eyes and shoulder-length blonde hair. On August 28th, one of her identification cards was found near the north gate of the Anacostia Naval Station. 2 days later, her government access card was found on a city street. But Ruth Morgenstern was still missing. Her file included the notation, "Most likely dead." I wondered, was Ruth Morgenstern dead? How about Mrs. Elizabeth Connolly? Around 10, just as I was starting to do some serious yawning, I came across another case that snapped my mind to attention. I read the report once, then a second time. It involved the abduction 11 months earlier of a woman named Jilly Lopez in Houston. The kidnapping had occurred at the Houstonian Hotel. A team, two males, had been seen loitering near the victim's SUV in the parking garage. Mrs. Lopez was described as very attractive. Minutes later, I was speaking to the officer in Houston who had handled the case. Detective Steve Bowen was curious about my interest in the abduction, but he was cooperative. He said that Mrs. Lopez hadn't been found or heard from since she disappeared. No ransom was ever requested. She was a real good lady. Just about everybody I talked to loved her. I'd heard the same thing about Elizabeth Connolly when I was in Atlanta. I already hated this case, but I couldn't get it out of my skull. White girl. The women who'd been taken were all lovable, weren't they? It was the thing they had in common. Maybe it was the kidnapper's pattern. Lovable victims. How awful was that?
Chapter 22.
When I got home that night, it was 11:15, but there was a surprise waiting for me. A good one. John Sampson was sitting on the front steps. All 6'9", 250 pounds of him. He looked like the Grim Reaper at first, but then he grinned and looked like the Joyful Reaper. "Look who it is, Detective Sampson," I smiled back.
"How's it going, man?" John asked as I walked across the lawn. "You're working kind of late again. Same old, same old. You never change, man."
"This is the first late night I've had at Quantico," I responded, a little defensively.
"Don't start." "Did I say anything bad? Did I even cut you with the first of many line that's right there on the tip of my tongue?" "No, I didn't. I'm being good. For me. But since we're talking, you can't help yourself, can you?"
"Want a cold beer?" I asked, and unlocked the front door of the house. "Where's your bride tonight?" Sampson followed me inside, and we got a couple of Heinekens each. We took them out to the sun porch. I sat on the piano bench, and John plopped down in the rocker, which strained under his weight. John is my best friend in the world, and has been since we were 10 years old. We were homicide detectives and partners, until I went over to the FBI. He's still a little pissed at me for that.
"Billy's just fine. She's working the late shift at St. Anthony's tonight and tomorrow. We're doing good."
He drained about half of his beer in a gulp.
"No complaints, partner. Far from it. You're looking at a happy camper." I had to laugh.
"You seem surprised."
Sampson laughed, too. "Guess I didn't think I was the marrying kind. Now all I want to do is hang with Billy most of the time. She makes me laugh. And she even gets my jokes. How about you and Jamila? She good? And how is the new job? How's it feel to be a Phoebe down at Club Fed?"
"I was just gonna call Jam," I told him. Sampson had met Jamila, liked her, and knew our situation. Jam was a homicide detective too, so she understood what the life was like. I really enjoyed being with her. Unfortunately, she lived in San Francisco, and she loved it out there. "She's on another murder case. They kill people in San Francisco, too. Life in the Bureau is good so far." I popped open the second of my beers. "I need to get used to the bureaucrats, though."
"Uh-oh," Sampson said. Then he grinned wickedly. "Crack in the walls already? The bureaucrats. Authority problems? So why are you working so late? Aren't you still in orientation, whatever they call it?"
I told Sampson about the kidnapping of Elizabeth Connolly, the condensed version. But then we moved back to more pleasant subjects. Billy and Jamila, the allure of romance, the latest George Pelicanos novel, a detective friend of ours who was dating his partner and didn't think anybody was onto them. But we all knew. It was like it always was when Sampson and I got together. I missed working with him. Which led to the next thought. I needed to figure out some way to get him into the FBI. The big man cleared his throat.
"Something else I wanted to tell you. Talk to you about. Real reason I came over tonight," he said.
I raised an eyebrow.
"Oh?
What's that?"
His eyes avoided mine. "Kinda difficult for me, Alex."
I leaned forward. He had me hooked. Then Sampson smiled, and I knew it was good, whatever he was about to share.
"Billy's got herself pregnant," he said, and laughed his deepest, richest laugh. Then Samson jumped up and bear-hugged me half to death. I'm gonna be a father.
Chapter 23.
Here we go again, my darling Zoya, said Slava in a conspiratorial whisper. You look very prosperous, by the way. Just perfect for today.
The couple looked like all the other suburban types wandering around the crowded King of Prussia Mall, the second largest in America, according to promotional signs at all the entrances. There was good reason for the mall's popularity. Greedy shoppers traveled here from the surrounding states because Pennsylvania had no tax on clothing.
These people all look so wealthy. They have their shit together, said Slava. Don't you think? You know the expression I'm using, having your shit together? It's American. Slang.
Zoya snorted out a nasty laugh.
We'll see how together their shit is in an hour or so, after we've done our business here. Their fear lies about a quarter of an inch below the surface. Just like everybody else in this spoiled, rotten country. They're afraid of their own shadows, but especially pain, or even a little discomfort. Can't you see that on their faces, Slava? They're afraid of us. They just don't know it yet.
Slava looked around the main plaza, which was dominated by Nordstrom and Neiman Marcus. There were signs up everywhere for Teen People magazine's Rock and Shop Tour. Meanwhile, their target had just bought a $50 box of cookies at Neiman's. Amazing. Then she bought something equally absurd called a red, white, and blue dog journal, which was prohibitively expensive as well.
Stupid, stupid people. Keeping notebooks for a dog, Slava thought.
Then he spotted the target again. She was coming out of Skechers with her small children in tow. Actually, the target looked a little apprehensive to them at the moment. Why was that? Maybe she was afraid that she would be recognized and have to sign an autograph or make small talk with her fans.
Price of fame, eh?
She moved quickly now, guiding the precious little ones into Dick Clark's American Bandstand Grill, presumably for lunch, but maybe just to escape the crowds.
Dick Clark came from Philadelphia, near here, Slava said. Did you know that? Who the hell cares about Dick Clark? Dick Tracy or Dick Less, said Zoya, and hammered Slava's bicep with her fist. Stop these stupid trivia games. It gives me a headache. Excedrin headache number 1 trillion since I met you.
The target certainly fit the description they had been given by their controller. Tall, blonde, ice queen, full of herself. But also tasty, down to the last detail, thought Slava. It made sense, he supposed. She had been purchased by a client who called himself the art director. The couple waited about 50 minutes. A middle school choir from Broomall, Pennsylvania was performing in the atrium. Then the target and her two kids emerged from the restaurant.
Let's do it, said Slava. This should be interesting, no? The kids make it the challenge.
No, Zoya said. The kids make it insane. Wait until the wolf hears about this. He'll have puppies. That's American slang, by the way.
Chapter 24.
The name of the woman who'd been purchased was Audrey Meek. She was a celebrity, having founded a highly successful line of women's fashions and accessories called Meek. It was her mother's maiden name and the one she used herself. The couple watched her closely, tailed her into the parking garage without creating suspicion. They jumped her as she was putting her Neiman Marcus and Hermes and other shopping bags into a shiny black Lexus SUV with New Jersey plates.
Children, run! Run away!
Audrey Meek struggled fiercely as Zoya tried to stuff an acrid-smelling gauzy cloth over her nose and mouth. Soon she saw circles, stars, and bright colors for a few dramatic seconds. Then she finally passed out in Slava's powerful arms. Zoya peered around the parking garage. It was nothing much to look at, cement walls with numbers.